This is the Lean Into Art Cast.
Whether it's illustration, cartooning, UI design, or presenting, it all comes down to telling your story, communicating your ideas. But it ain't for the faint of heart. But let's lean into it.
And I did too.
You did too. I did too.
Conversation midstream. Jersey Drozd. That's who I'm talking to.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I don't want to turn to that guy. Oh, man.
Kool-Aid Man? He seems to have fun.
Oh, Kool-Aid Man is fun. Kool-Aid Man is awesome because he blasts through a wall.
Exactly. His walls are our metaphors for challenges in our lives.
Already we're doing that. Oh, yep. That's awful. Hey, Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com.
Yeah.
You know, I realized when I was doing the show notes for the show last week and I was typing in the URL for your website, interactive-storyteller.com, that we were doing a lab just days before for Lean Into Arts 30 Classes in 30 Days. And I was giving Earl advice and I said, you know, I think it's more important to not have a hyphen in your URL rather than having a .com or something like that.
Hyphens.
I was saying something about like hyphens were worse for a URL than whether or not you have a .com, a .me, .org, .biz. And then I was 2 days later typing interactive-storyteller.com. Oh, whoops.
No, it's cool. There's a lot of things that you know I have a preference about, yeah. that due to my certain situation or the choices that are available or my resources at hand, I end up compromising and feeling pretty good about it because I went through the series of trade-offs. Yeah. Right? So to me, I landed on using the hyphen or the dash in interactive-storyteller.com because those two words were really important to me. And I've already been using them in my brand a lot. Mm-hmm. It's not like I was coming up with a new story. I was building upon an existing story about, you know, trying to encapsulate what I'm offering and with a phrase that I want people to associate with me.
Right. That's good branding. You know, and I don't know. I don't have a whole ton of thoughts on this. Like a year ago, I remember everybody was talking about your URLs need to be short because everybody was using link shorteners and everybody was using Twitter to promote everything. And so the shorter your URL, the better. But, you know, that's always going to be changing because, I mean, like now with things like, you know, well, Facebook, Google Plus, there's no link shortening going on there. You don't need to worry about it in those environments. If that's where you're going to do your, you know, social commerce. So, I don't know. So, like, I wrestled with this when I was coming up with a URL for the new front comic that I'm doing. Mm. And was I going to do thefrontcomic.com? I'm not such a fan of that. It always bums me out when you have to put comic after your comic's title. It feels like when you put like numbers after your name in your email address.
Sure.
Because it's like, oh, that name was taken by 1,274 people because you're, you know, Jersey 1,275. It always just harkens to that. It elicits that in me. So I landed on the front.me and I thought, well, we'll see. We'll see if that sticks or not. If it doesn't, who cares?
Nice that you got that. That short URL. I mean, there's those trade-offs. So a .me, is that the same feel as a .com?
Right.
Like artgeekzoo .com. I have that. It's not, and at some point in the next year, that'll turn from, you know, literally the name of the comic into like more of an imprint name. We'll see as I have time to work on that project. But I actually went and bought sort of a secondary URL just to have something really short. So I got agz.me.
Oh, cool.
And I have that on my recent banners. So I was playfully just trying to have something really simple where I know it sounds weird or counterintuitive, but I guess sometimes I like to just experiment on myself and do weird and counterintuitive things and see what the results are. And then oftentimes bump my head and go, oh, that's why people do this better or whatever. So I actually had no material on my tables this last year at conventions that had my URL on it. I just would tell people, or I'd cause it to be an interaction where I'd write it down.
Hmm. So to make the actual URL a little bit more memorable to them because they're watching you write it rather than just having it flash across their eyes on a card kind of idea?
Exactly. It's a more meaningful interaction than just here's a card.
That, you know what? Yesterday I was teaching a class and a couple parents came up to me and asked if I teach anyplace else. And I said, oh, indeed I do. And they said, well, do you have a card? I didn't have any cards on me. I ran out. I got to order some more. And so I wrote out comicsaregreat.com on a piece of paper and handed it to them. And because I wrote it in front of them, they stopped and read it and then said, comics are great, huh? And then I said, yeah, it's my mantra and my brand, you know? So there was an opportunity there for just like a little bit of a, you know, create a memorable moment. They're going to remember that URL. It's more likely they're going to remember that URL now, right?
Yep, exactly. Trying to create more connections in their brain regarding that whole interaction.
And, so you wouldn't use a QR code for that?
No, I've experimented with QR codes, but just as a playful thing.
Yeah.
That only was a point of conversation when I did it on my table because people are like, what's that?
It looks like Pac-Man barfed on your business card.
Yeah, exactly. Did you stomp on a space invader? I think they're really cool in what they do and their concept, but it's tough. Yeah. It's a tough concept to make practical, but enough people are working at it. It should become simpler. The big thing is that QR codes need a default application that's ubiquitous. And right now it's sort of this extra hidden thing. It's like what before web browsers were common or something. It's just, you have a URL. What do I do with it?
Yeah, that's the common argument I hear against QR codes is that until it's just something built into everything with a camera, right, then it's never going to have much uptake. But I don't want to talk too much about tech, but I do like what this thought about you being playful and intuitive with what you how you engage with your art. Does this amount to thinking more critically about how you engage with your work?
It does. It does. It absolutely comes to play. And I think critical thinking is it's not like this opposite oil and water mix with creative activities. And I know it's like permeated a lot of what we've talked about on Lean Into Artcast. Yeah. And heck, on our about page, I mean, you could probably say that in a way that's sort of a manifesto for incorporating sort of a critical thinking feedback loop between teacher and artist, and sort of a open participatory culture between each, that you're less interested in the hierarchy of those roles and more into the function of getting something fun and useful accomplished.
I wanted to do a lot of prep for this, and I have to admit defeat that I did not. Because you pitched this at me last night, and I thought, well, it'd be really good if I sat down with a piece of paper and jotted down like six big ideas that I think about when I think about thinking critically, like why thinking critically is so important to me in my classroom environments and then also in my own personal life and in my creative pursuits. And you caught me flat-footed with that one. Because I realized I have just taken it for granted that it's just what you do. That's not a good enough reason. That's not a good enough reason to do anything, you know, at least not for me. You know, it's just not done. It's not right to not do this, you know.
I would say that so in being playful and, you know, discovering things, There's kind of a progression, like when I'm trying techniques, where I'll be ridiculously aware of why I'm doing it at first, and then if it's successful and I like it and I somehow make some like a technique a part of my process, that deliberate aspect really vanishes. So I may not be able to readily speak on it anymore once it's become a habit. Is that are you saying this is a habit for you?
I think it is. I think it's ingrained into who I am as a I don't want to say who I am as a person. What's a better way to say that? Doesn't sound so dumb.
Your genetic material?
Maybe. It's baked into me now. And I do remember that when I was teaching my first real teaching gig, which was with ArtServe Michigan, and I was visiting all these different classrooms in Detroit, and I was doing what I thought was right. You know, I'm doing the best I can. I think this is right, but I don't know. I don't have any training in this field. They kind of threw me in the pool and said, swim, sucker, swim. And my boss and my friend Mary Jo, who was there in a sort of an advisory capacity, showed up to monitor one of my classes. And I was sweating bullets because these guys are the experts, you know. And then afterwards, Mary Jo came up to me. She put her arm around me and she said a swear, you know, like that kind of exasperated, like, holy cow, holy moly kind of swear. But something else. And she's like, that was amazing. She's like, you're a natural. And you know, you hear that and you think, oh, you're being nice. But that's how I reacted. I was like, yeah, well, you know, I think I did okay. Did I do good? I don't know. And she said, no, you know, what you did was you encouraged the kids to think for themselves. You didn't push information on them. You pulled information out of them. And I thought, well, isn't that what you're supposed to do? She's like, well, yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. You're just doing it intuitively. You're doing it without thinking. And so my experience there made me more aware of how to utilize this kind of whatever martial arts skill, and be more mindful of it. But from like what I'm trying to get at here, this long anecdote is about how even when I was first teaching, I was automatically doing that. It's just it's been part of my personal makeup to not be the big loudmouth bullhorn expert pushing information on people, but more interested in hearing what they know and how can I align that with what I know. Does that make sense?
I think that totally makes sense. It just exemplifies a different outlook where I guess all of us have probably at some point been through sort of a teaching experience that involved a lot less. One of the opposite things of creative thinking would be like remote critical thinking would be just rote memorization.
Yeah.
So it's saying that the act of you processing what you know and somehow comparing and contrasting and trying to prove and disprove something that you know, throw that aside. Just repeat this thing in this order.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think about when I was in high school, I flunked Algebra 2. I flunked it hard and crash and burn. Like the teacher said, like, you're never going to amount to anything, kid. Geometry took it the year before, which was all solving proofs, you know, figure out what this angle is. And then you got to show the logical path to discovering what that angle was. A+ in the class. I called the teacher at home. The teacher gave us his home phone number and said, if you have any problems with the proofs, you know, you can always call me and I can walk you through and get you back on track. I would call him just to tell him what a good time I had dealing with these proofs because it was so much fun to do to figure out, you know, use deductive reasoning to get to this answer. Oh God, no wonder I wasn't popular. But anyway, my point is that, yeah, there was the teaching experience where it was Algebra 2, where the teacher was like, he was like one of those guys where he was 2 years away from retirement, didn't care, and just like memorized these equations. Geometry, on the other hand, was all about logic and breaking things down and trying to come to the answer through logical thinking rather than through memorizing. You had some memorization, right? There was like Pythagorean theorem and whatnot. But anyway.
Oftentimes you may have a building block and then you get to know that building block's strengths by putting it to use and exercising it and learning the results of exercising that building block. And then it becomes a tool and you gain a familiarity with it.
Yeah.
Some things are just that way. I suppose we all have to memorize the alphabet at some point and we start memorizing different rules of our languages.
Mm-hmm.
That led our... you know, brain structures adapt to processing information in the world around us and remember things better and whatnot, and then express ideas and communicate. this topic of critical thinking, it hit me that with what we're doing at Lean Into Art. Like I mentioned how like our about page in some ways is like a manifesto about that. And you could chalk it up to my love of being overly explicit about stuff. But I also think it's worth questioning things, pretty much everything.
Yeah.
At least once in a while. So, right. We are, and also like just sitting back, looking at like what we've been producing during 30 classes in 30 days and looking back at our podcast, which is young. But, you know, we have sort of some baked in feel for it already and whatnot. And I do think what that is probably related to using critical thinking, even though you're an artist. And
I think I'm guessing that part of this probably came out of an observing the labs that we've done through 30 classes in 30 days. And one of the things we did with the labs is we leveraged them as a way to sort of create supplementary material for some of the ongoing classes. So I taught this 4-part series, Comics Fundamentals. And there was a lot of content to pack into 4 1-hour sessions. There's a lot of content in there. And in a lot of assignments, I was asking a lot of the people participating, you know, it's like, okay, we're at week 2. So now you should have a good sense of your characters and your story and you should be onto the thumbnailing by now. Wow. That's a lot to ask somebody to do. And so we did the labs as an opportunity to follow up and create more thinking strategies for how to get at the nut of your story. But at no time did either of us say, well, step one, sit down with your piece of paper and turn it portrait or landscape orientation, because landscape orientation leads to better and clearer thinking after all, and make sure that you have a cup of Earl Grey tea there. Not coffee, but Earl Grey tea, because tea helps your brain process information better. And step three, you know, we never did that. We never said, here's the steps and just follow along with this. And if you fail, it's your fault. You messed up because you didn't follow my plan to the letter. You know, we've talked about this before, this kind of commoditization of inspiration and teaching and the self-help guru. And this was the first big thought I had about why I think critical thinking is so important. I didn't write it down, but I sort of like bookmarked it mentally. Mm. Is that to not foster critical thinking, and I'm not talking about classroom experience. If I'm not fostering critical thinking, then I'm fostering dependency. The students depend on me for information and for inspiration and for guidance. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get them, at least this is one of those things that like Mary Jo congratulated me for, but where I was like, well, I thought that's what you're supposed to do. It's like being, you know, congratulated for putting your pants on this morning. It's just what you do, right? It's like you get the kids to feel empowered to be able to do this on their own, to be able to take it on without you. So they don't need you anymore, but odds are they're still going to come back to you because they had good, you know, they associate all these good feelings around the experience they had with you. I'm still in touch to this day with dozens of students who have since moved on from my classes, but they touch base with me. Some of them, you know, every time they come back to the home state to visit their parents, touching base with me is a stop along the way. Like I'm like an old uncle that they want to go say hi to, and they can't miss out on seeing me while they're in town, kind of idea. So it's not like, it's not like they're going to forget you if they have independence. So I don't know why people are so, well, I get why people are so hung up on this idea of fostering dependence, because that's how you form a business, right?
Exactly. I think there's a model that we are immersed in that we get to experience that other way, that other approach quite often, which is a sort of a territory occupation and defense, which has to do with creating some exclusivity and dependency regarding gaining something like a product or knowledge, and some institutions approach knowledge in that way. Let's see, names.
So
I don't know. We
all know people. I mean, like, okay, like think of any mass media guru who has more than 2 books written. And I would even lump David Allen in this. You know, David Allen, sure, great guy, but, you know, he's got a business based on this whole, get the David Allen GTD wallet, really? You know, if they have more than 2 books, yeah, then it says to me that, and I'm not saying that people shouldn't write books either. I'm just saying that, and I'm saying it's an effective business strategy. Good for them. They're making money. But one of the things that that kind of commoditization of inspiration and education does for me is that it turns me off, because it's not about, it seems like ultimately it can't be about empowering me, because here's the new product I got to get in order to keep helping me. Or is that something where it's like, I'll be generous in this and I'll say, maybe this is because there's always a new person coming in and there's people who maybe have to take longer to get through the system to become independent and whatnot, and they need more materials in order to do that. Okay, if that's the case, great, you know. But so in other words, Rob, we're crazy and we're throwing our lives away into a business that will never work because ultimately we want people to not need us.
That some people would say exactly, and then shut the podcast off. But if they,
what am I going to tell my wife? What am I going to tell my wife, Rob?
Where's the rent going to come from, et cetera?
But I'm changing lives. Yes, but we don't have any food.
Well, let's see. I know it freaks. Let's say a lot of times when I consult doing a user experience design, user centric design type things or whatever. I don't know if it's this is a mantra I have is I try to work myself out of a job every day. And it scares the heck out of some people, depending on who hears it. But some people, when they hear it, they're like, oh, okay, cool. That means you're not here to be a parasite, and you're going to help when we need you, and share what you know and do it in a transparent way, and then come back if we need you again, or wish us well if you don't, or whatever. I look at it as depends on how you look at scarcity, maybe. Because to me, I felt really safe and confident in adopting that mantra. It's a some official, I repeat it all the time mantra, but like it's a thing. I mean, if you've worked with me, you've probably heard me say it at least once within a year, whatever.
Yeah.
Let's see. It's not that basically there's no scarcity in problems to solve. Especially in that domain, people are going to keep building systems. People need the systems to serve other people. That's an act of communication. There's a lot of things that are worth puzzling and solving and refining and improving in design and whatnot. And as long as that exists, there's jobs in it. So I'm not worried about it. So that where's it going to come from? For you, there's no scarcity in people keep growing up and getting curious about learning art and comics and forms of visual communication. There's more people to teach, and they can visit you at different stages of their learning too. And
I'm constantly reminded that there's, when you talk about comics and teaching comics classes, there's nowhere to go but up, because we still have a lot of ground to cover in the United States in terms of parents understanding that comics is a thing that can be taught and is a skill that can be learned and is a career that some people can follow. But also in terms of just the arts in general, in terms of, right now we're talking mostly about education and consultancy, right? But I think there's parallels to, you know, critical thinking in your own work. One of the things that I've heard friends jokingly throw at me about all this teaching work and advocacy work that I do is that it's like I'm writing the documentary about my career before it's time to write the documentary about my career, right? Like if the documentarian's not going to come and cover me and like do a story on all of my innermost thoughts about comics, I'm going to go to the public and barf it out on them. Well, can you hold on a second, Rob?
Sure.
Loud just knocked over something really big, and nothing's damaged. Nobody's hurt, so good.
Okay, good.
I just heard a big boom upstairs. Anyway, so where was I?
Documentary.
I'm trying to think of what my original thought was about that.
Where you're saying it's it also relates to using critical thinking in your own work.
Oh yes. Yeah, so they make fun of me. They pick on me about that. But then, part of it is that it came out of the sense that, or what I discovered is that by putting myself in an environment where I had to teach kids and had to organize my process in some kind of demonstrated, is it demonstrable? Is that the word?
Demonstrative, demonstrable, yeah.
Something like that. In a way that can be presented and absorbed by an audience, it made me think a lot harder about how I do what I do. You know, this is because I didn't want to just come in with sophistry and say, well, let's see, let's look at this, how to write book. Oh, this is what this guy says. Here's what that guy says. Just do what these guys say. And I'm here to present that information to you. I wanted it to be, okay, I have to sit down and go, how do I do this stuff? Right? And it's not, I'm not going to do the crazy old jazz musician thing and say, like this, doodly 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 doo, you know?
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing. So it's like so questioning, it's almost like, is it because you're creating a defensible stance? So if someone says, well, why are you teaching this?
No. Maybe it is. I don't know. What I discovered was, I guess I didn't finish all my points on this, is that I found out that my work was benefiting from being more thoughtful about it. I discovered that writer's block and inspiration were, a weak stance that I had to excuse myself from getting work done. And once I had more critical thinking and analysis going on, I had more entry points than ever to get back into just doing things again, right? I had ways to coax myself off the ledge. I had ways to come up with new ideas. I had ways to convince myself to just put something on paper and not fall back into that emotional stance of, oh, woe is me. I'm the Lady of Shalott. All is despair and I'll never get any work done or any good work done. So my work benefited from that. And then the last big point, and this is probably the most important point for me personally, is I discovered it was just really fun to talk about this stuff with other creative people. It was invigorating to just chew on a subject and not feel like I have to get to the bottom of it and have to win the game, but rather play the game. Does that say anything? Do those words amount to a sentence of some sort?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's... I would argue this topic is going to get very meta because as you go about it, and I'm going to say to the extent of, you're asking for my critical perspective on what you just expressed.
Yes.
And I would ask of our audience, yes, the ideal for doing this kind of thing, it'd be wonderful to, be an endorsement of that kind of thinking to the extent where you know why you're listening to this and what you are getting out of it or not getting out of it. That critical thinking is sort of a way to, toward the information sources you end up choosing that, it's like just as if you're providing a service, but you're not quite sure how it's coming about. You can benefit by thinking about, well, why and how, and learn by interacting with other practitioners, like what you just described, Jersey, mm-hmm. and see that somehow you are quicker, faster, better, something improving about what you're providing, whether it's teaching or whether it's, design work, dance, anything. I mean, if you can ask, ask interesting questions and explore those questions and come to conclusions that you feel are like, oh, that's pretty darn reasonable. That's like the most ridiculous handy skill I've ever had. And maybe it's I've always assumed that someone knows way more than me and can come along and say, like you mentioned the guitarist example. And I know I'm meandering a little bit, but, growing up, I mean, there was during a time when guitar is still pretty celebrated as an instrument, but there was an incredibly intense worshipful time of that during the 80s.
Oh yeah,
and and I was bitten by the bug, still am. Right?
Did you play a Flying V?
No, not yet.
Flying V that's painted to look like a lady wearing a bikini.
Never wanted that kind of Flying V, but that's someday when I'll get a Flying V, but not this day.
Green with white tiger stripes.
No. Maybe it'll be painted just like Crunchy or whatever. I mean, yeah, Crunchy in my comic, he represents my, you know, my desire for a flying bee.
Right. That's why I was wondering about that.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I wasn't worried about having it be, you know, like a Gibson S Explorer with a free beer sticker on it, you know, like Hetfield or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, but those flying bees are pretty. guitar aesthetics aside, there's a, oh gosh, there's a certain technical proficiency worship, yet maybe not the strongest means of distributing that knowledge going on. Mm-hmm. And so you had certain people that would gain high technical proficiency and not be kind about sharing what they know. That can be very, that was like an example for me where I'm like I felt pretty torn down after any time I'd interact with a guitarist like that. And for me, they weren't that uncommon to run into in the circles I traveled in. I respected their technique and their skill. It was wonderful. I think that's amazing and super cool. But at the same time, I think they gave me a good anti-lesson where I'm like, that's not how you teach and that's not how I want to learn. I want to be able to, when someone asks me why about what I'm doing, I want to be able to say why. Because especially I find myself on the edge of like barely knowing enough on a lot. exploring new technology, new techniques and whatnot.
Language that I use in my classrooms a lot. It's used, I would venture to say in every classroom I work in is because is not an answer. Nobody gets to say because. Like you can say whatever you want, whatever's on your mind, and you will not be penalized for it. But if you say because, then you're marked down. You know, and I'm in the fortunate position that nobody gets graded in my classes. I'm not beholden to any kind of like curriculum. You know, even when the high schools I teach, I have the option to do just pass or fail, right? So, and I was like, this is a pass or fail course. I'm not going to give you an A, B, C, or D kind of grading scale. So I don't have to, real, you know, professional teachers have it way harder than I do in that regard. But one of the rules of my classroom is that you have to defend your position. You have to justify your thoughts on this stuff, even if you can't really find the words for it. You have to try to find the words for it. And maybe, you know, I'm wondering if that's a little bit unfair sometimes because here's what I was thinking about as you were talking is midichlorians.
Oh.
Midichlorians, they ruined the Star Wars franchise. Everybody says so. Everybody says so. It demystified the Force. It explained it away. It's no longer magic. And
Oh God, you just hit me where it hurts, dude. Cheers to the midichlorians. So frustrating. Let's see. I think there are other explanations of magic. Being someone that has role played in various systems and whatnot.
Yeah.
I remember when I'd been a player of Dungeons and Dragons, like very poorly from a young age, and then learn more about it to get more into it. Cause you know, when you're young, it's all this interesting stats and fantasy acquisition of treasure and cool stuff. And like really hard to follow, especially at the time. Like, I mean, the original Dungeon Master's Guide is madness to follow. But like, still fascinating for a kid who wants to learn rules and gets excited by learning and trying to apply them in a fantasy way, whatever. And let's see. But then I came across the idea that like spells weren't just something you memorized. Like they had these components and then they used stuff and then magic comes from somewhere. And there's these trade-offs of using magic. That blew me away at a young age. I was very, very frustrated and disappointed by that because I thought you just ruined my idea of magic. And, but eventually, slowly but surely, I ended up acclimating to it. And
so you learn to live with life's disappointments.
Exactly. Yeah, I learned that I can live with scars. It's okay.
Oh, man.
No, I don't know what it was, but it had a new appeal, actually, that angle on it. Like I found like some kind of new hook on something that I was familiar with that I thought I was really familiar with that I realized I wasn't. And that discovery did lead to new exciting things. Whereas midichlorians, I never found that next level, that next hook. I don't it just didn't seem to be as artfully considered. And whereas I suppose, you know, Dungeons and Dragons borrowed from all sorts of mythologies throughout human history to create something that's fairly, in some way has enough cultural, anecdotal, story familiarity where it's just like, okay, I can accept this if I'm going to accept the fantasy of magic, right?
Uh-huh.
But yeah, midichlorians, the fact that it was tacked on and the extra, oh God. So are you getting, I'm just to try to like, bit, sometimes, is what you're saying, Jersey, that sometimes an explanation sucks?
What I'm saying is, how else were they going to know? How else would they know that Anakin is more powerful than Yoda? That's all I'm saying. You can't do that in a story unless you say that you have little magic people inside your cells that talk to you.
You know, Dragon Ball Z pulled it off. It was in a, it's a lame tacked on way also, but they had
with the little visor.
Exactly. They have a power meter.
Yeah.
That they don't explain it though. They don't like say there's a way to measure and perceive this relative capability, but then exactly what that relative capability is, at least in the anime, I don't feel it was ever explicitly midichloriand.
Well, all I was using the midichlorians as a metaphor for an argument that I've encountered with fellow cartoonists. Now I want to back up real quick and say something about my position on artists in general, because I know everybody's clamoring for that. Actually, nobody cares. But it's our show. I get to say if I want to. No, I think that there are some people who just have an intuitive knack for it. And there's something nonverbal that's happening when they're engaging with their craft. And they can't put words to it. It's difficult. It's nearly impossible to explain it all away. And that's where I think maybe sometimes I'm being unfair to my kids when I say, no, you have to try to explain it to me. And, you know, at that age, you're talking like ages like 7 to 18, they're only taking my class like once a week, maybe once every 6 months. So it's not like I'm, you know, putting them in a boiler pot and say, think critically, damn it, you know. but I'm exposing them to the idea that maybe this is a way of approaching it. But anyway, you know, it's like I've talked with artists who, you know, they it's difficult for them to do that. And B, they're not interested in that. It just happens. It comes out of them. And that magic is appealing to them. And for me to come in and go, oh, well, you know, this, you use red here because red indicates this, or it tends to indicate this to people. And that's the funny thing is that I never profess that I have the definitive answer. It's like, I suspect that this is what's going on, you know, like rather than come in and, you know, dispel the magic, I'm just trying to find out, like, I wonder if there's some underlying principles here that are kind of oscillating around and turning from matter to antimatter, from gas to water, and then it's all coming through the filter of your mind into this really interesting thing is all I'm trying to figure out. But to these people, I'm midichlorian-ing it. I'm putting midichlorians on something that really should be a kind of a mystical, spiritual experience for them, you know?
Sure.
So all I'm trying to say is that while if you come into my classroom, you're going to hear a lot about critical thinking. I don't want anybody to think that I'm trying to indoctrinate the world and everybody should think critically. And if you don't, if it's difficult for you, well, guess what? That's what you know, genetic culling is for. And we'll figure out what to do with you people, you know.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Obviously, the world isn't black and white. Let's move on, kind of thing. It's okay to have strong feelings about something and endorse the heck out of it in a way, and explain it. But at the same time, of course, other people don't have to see it that way, and you know, we can live together. I would say that in general, even an artist in their most mystical and transcendent moments. Let's see. So let's say that when that comes to pass, and they don't want a midichlorian in their process, they don't want to turn it into, you know, it truly is something that is a I don't know. Is that the word? Does the word spiritual fit there?
It's something I don't know. You know, that's
meant to be a natural phenomena, a thing that doesn't have to get mired in with the human intellect playing with it, right?
Because intuitive. An intuitive.
It exists
thing.
Either way. Yeah, it's intuitive. That's totally cool. And I respect that, of course. I would say, though, even for folks of that interest, critical thinking, if they leave their art studio after having such a wonderful transcendent session, then they go to their elevator in their art studio building and they push the down button. It shows up. They enter the elevator. It starts going down, then gets stuck. I'm going to say time for some critical thinking. You know, like there's going to be a point that you're going to run into obstacles that you'll need you'll need to do that. And if you want to incorporate it deeply or in a shallow way or just slightly barely connected to your art, that's whatever. That's fine. But as an agenda, yeah, I absolutely am waving the flag of it.
Yeah, saying, same here. Of course. We found what works for us and we're excited about it, you know?
Yep.
Unfortunately, you know, there's always going to be somebody who takes it as like some kind of, you're telling me X, you're telling me to live my life by X, Y, and Z. Oh, that's what we said at the top that we're not doing, but...
In fact, if you were, you know, here's the meta.
It's the Monty Python joke. It's the Monty Python joke, right? What was it that Brian, Life of Brian, says? He's standing and talking to that big crowd of people. It's like, I am an individual and I think for myself. And then that one guy, and then the crowd repeats it back to him. And the one guy in the back goes, I'm not, you know.
Yeah, it is. Here you go. There's the irony. You know, aren't we silly humans?
But yes, that is the funny part about it, and that it's always funny to get that one person kind of shaking their fist at you because, anyway.
Good point. I see the irony because of course you could critique us, but then of course we've trapped you, and then you know it's like fighting against the dark side in Star Wars. There you go.
Go back there again.
You know, intellectual traps, huh?
Intellectual traps, audio traps. I don't know what a lot of breaks, a lot of pauses in this episode. We're usually
usually record
in one take.
Mysteries of the universe.
Are you quoting UHF?
No.
Oh, no, Secrets of the Universe. Secrets of the Universe with that crazy guy. Played by soap opera actor, Luke from General Hospital. I can't remember the actor's name. It doesn't matter.
Yep.
Doesn't matter. Good movie though, UHF.
I still need to see it. I never caught the whole thing.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you.
Oh, Rob.
I know. I'm.
It's on Netflix. Yeah. It's on Netflix right now. You should make a date with your family to see that movie. It's so funny.
Cool. Writing it down.
So... I don't know. I mean, we talked about benefits of, you know, how it benefits our work to think critically, getting us out of quote unquote writer's block or giving us more kinds of procedures to get back to working on the page, ways to talk ourselves off the ledge by stepping back and having like a more abstract conception of what we're trying to accomplish, right? So it's not as simple as, did you pass or did you fail today? I failed, therefore I don't deserve to be on this planet. Well, I can back out and I can look at the larger picture of what I'm trying to accomplish, right? That helps keep me in the game. And then there's like the critical thinking that is important when you're working in a classroom and encouraging your students to be self-reliant and to not have to keep coming back to you for, what do I do next, Mr. Drost? What next? What do I do now? I don't know what to do. I can't think for myself, right? And then there's also the fun aspect. It's just it's a fun game to play. It's intellectual martial arts that you get to do with others.
And I'd say you're back on the threshold where it comes full circle, where... critical thinking is also a kind of creative thinking, and you are enacting a different style of creativity because it can be so playful And it can be so integrated back and forth between. That's why I do feel it's a false dichotomy a lot of times when we pit the two against each other, where there's just purely the transcendent emotional experience of the brush is moving. Who knows what's moving the brush? And then, clearly I wanted the brush to move here from coordinates, you know, X, Y to da, da, da. You know, it's whatever with the, you know, so many pounds of pressure at this point and, you know, minus this point, right. Whatever.
You're literally moving like an assembly line robot on the page. Yeah,
exactly. That's, that does both approaches it a disservice to make them hard categories of such polar opposites.
Mm-hmm.
Cause it's both, I don't know.
You oscillate between the two. You oscillate between the two all the time. I've told the story multiple times of when an entire idea, premise, and general concept of the first issue of a comic came to me while I was grocery shopping. And I got so lost in that imaginary world that I wound up buying things that I didn't intend to buy. And I left the store and I came to and I had a whole bunch of things that, what? I didn't need a wrench, you know? It was like that. It was like that off. And those are the moments you live for, man. Those are the moments where you feel like, wow, this was, it really does feel like a trip of some sort. You went on some kind of weird, you know, mental trip for a second.
Totally.
Got to be that absent mind. I don't even know what I was doing. I might've been talking to myself in the store. Who knows, you know? Cause I have no recollection of being in the store. I just remember walking in, the idea striking me, walking out of the store, weird stuff in a bag. Did I pay? I don't know. Try explaining that to a cop, right? Well, I was thinking about a comic. But anyway, you know, it's like those are great moments when you get lost in it, when you're in the full zone of the creative space and you sit down and you start working on the page and you look up again and the sun is setting, you know, mm-hmm. And you're like, where did the time go? But look at all the stuff that's in front of me. That, man, that's great. Working in like drawing actual perspective, like drawing proper mathematical perspective, becomes this meditative act. You know, you want to talk about, you know, transcendent spiritualism. It's like getting lost in doing all those methodical lines, like quiets my mind. It's a place where I get to go. Like it's almost like meditation. I love it for that. So yeah, you know, but then there's the days where I sit down and there's a blank page and it's the most terrifying thing in the world that the worst 15 minutes of the day is the 15 minutes where you try to talk yourself out of putting lines on that page. And if you lose that battle and then you, you know, go, well, that whiskey looks pretty good. You know, then it's over. And the only thing that's going to get you back to it again, at least for me, the only thing that's been successful is having that extra clip of critical thinking in my pocket to like remind me of, okay, let's back out and let's look at this thing conceptually. Let's look at what you want to accomplish. Let's not get too juvenile in our thinking here and get all emotional and hand-wringing about it. Right.
Yeah, because even in the end, when you are engaged in a transcendent act of producing some kind of art, you're still a person between these different transcendent moments. And obviously you want to put yourself in a position where you can keep doing it again. So if it ends in tragedy after every transcendent session and there's years in between or whoever knows, whatever, I don't know, wild tangents that sometimes I think we like to play with that sort of myth about the artist being the kook and, and we were like, that's a form of like society storytelling magic, right? Where, of course those abilities aren't within my grasp as, you know, I'm not this crazy artist. Who knows what the artist is going to say next?
They see colors differently. Cars look like ice cream cones to them. You know, it's we literally see the world differently. Well, in some ways, I think we do. I mean, in the sense of training, you know, it's like I can wireframe an object pretty easily now in my head, right? Mm-hmm. Because I've conditioned myself to see the world that way. But that's training, you know. That's not natural gift. That's not midichlorians.
No, it's damn midichlorians. Curses.
You turn into Colonel Clink.
Years and years of childhood love.
Wow. You know,
destroyed.
It never bothered me that much. I always just looked at it as a cheap plot device. It didn't ruin the Force. Well, see, but I've always been on I've always resented certain aspects of the Force. I hate that whole put the helmet over your eyes so you can't see. Your eyes can deceive you. Don't trust them. Don't trust your eyes. Don't trust your own critical faculties. Just listen to me, the old man. I know what's good for you. Just do what I say. Just trust me. Just do what I say. You'll
exactly.
be okay.
Yeah.
The Westerner in me goes when I hear that. So
yeah. See, you've come up with the strongest alternate interpretation of that in a negative way that I've ever heard. And it's yeah, I agree. I mean, that sucks. But to me, it's a one of the things to take out of the old Ben is that. I mean, we can get wisdom from anywhere. It doesn't matter like what our rank is or where we are in society. I mean, Ben is kind of this outcast. He still has validity in the overall picture of doing something constructive to help, you know, work against the big challenge and whatnot. Anyway,
my argument against that kind of notion is it becomes very clear early on that he is General Kenobi. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like if they would have not played that card, if Lucas would have like held that card back to the end, like, oh, you really are General Kenobi, you know, but yet Luke trusted him, then that argument would be stronger. But they established when R2-D2 puts that little hologram on the table, General Kenobi. Oh, OK. So he's a big deal. And even though he looks like a scruffy old bum, he was once a big deal. Now his words have a little bit more validity to him. You know, okay. I know that. The big idea of the first Star Wars film is believe in yourself, listen to your heart, and you can do this thing. You can do amazing things like blow up planets. And that's pretty cool. But my issues lie in him borrowing from Eastern philosophies and expressing them in a way that I think is potentially damaging to what values that we in the West hold very dear, such as critical thinking, individuality. And I'm not going to turn this into some kind of Billy Graham. I'm going to write a book about how Star Wars is evil. I'm just pointing out how the story kind of leaves me cold in a lot of ways. So I wasn't as invested when Phantom Menace came along.
No, I certainly still was, but I hadn't thought about it critically enough because, yeah, I mean, I have sometimes, you know, sometimes people only work out at the gym, right? So when it came to critical thinking, I mostly applied it to like my game projects and whatnot, and certain aspects. But then I, over the years, it's bled into everything. But and even then, that's not, you know, always the case, whatever. But it certainly is more widespread than it once was. So like I hadn't put that kind of thinking into it, and I think it's interesting too that you pointed out because so much of you know, our creative process, I mean, we're affected by the world around us. And I think it's interesting, like how maybe Lucas did that on purpose. Maybe that there is some anti-lesson, clever stuff that he's doing there regarding, I'm not trying to like pump him up or anything, but like, so he's soaking in a system that is about, you know, exclusive distribution and a lot of centralized thinking and an authoritarian approach to media. And so there's a little bit of an authoritarian message in there. I didn't realize it was there. I think that's a clever interpretation of it. So
the reason that in my mind, why Empire Strikes Back is the best movie, most people agree that Empire Strikes Back is one of the best, if not the best of all of the movies. And there's a lot of reasons for it. But one of the reasons I think that's most important to me is that's the one when Luke says, hey, teachers, F you. I'm going to go do the thing that I think is important, whether you think it's a good idea or not. That's the one where I think the message was very well constructed. That, and then yet, when he was in the critical moments where it gets really dark and bleak, he remembers the things that he learned from these old kooks, and that serves him. So yes, they do have information that is of use to him, but it's really important that he does it through his own volition. He gets there in his own path, his own way. Luke, you must not go. Vader's going to tempt you. Yeah, I know, but I'm going to do it anyway. Oh, he cut my hand off. I'm really mad. I'm really shaken up and I'm emotional, but I'm going to remember what Yoda and Obi-Wan said, and I'm not going to let myself get too worked up about this. I'm going to be calm, and I'm going to trust that I'm going to go wherever I need to go if I jump off this ledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that one had the strongest positive message for young people. But yeah, that first one is full of contradictions in my mind.
Yeah, and that is cool. Very, very good point. But I could see that coming arising out of a deliberate choice on Lucas's behalf, or because he's just soaking in that system.
Yeah,
and it's just, you know, a mouthpiece for the ideas of his generation.
Yeah,
which is a product of a few generations of humanity being in the throes of the Industrial Revolution, where we're all educated to work in factories and not lose our hands. Making mistakes is terrible.
And then everybody loses body parts in Star Wars movies. You're right.
There is that angle too. Yeah, you don't want to mess up with the on the lightsaber station at McDonald's.
I actually knew a guy who dropped something in the fryer vat and instinctively reached in for it. Yeah.
No way. Yeah. I saw that too. It was a kid who was frazzled. I was, it was when I was working. I was working at Burger King, and I was running the front areas and training this dude in on breakfast. And he just was frazzled in the beeps and the bloops and the.
Yeah.
Man.
It's noisy back there.
It is. It's noisy. And, you know, it just was, it's, I don't know.
He dropped the thing, and then, I just went like, oh, wait. And then, oh, no.
Yeah. Hospital time.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah. Anyway.
I don't know So I was trying, I was really trying to come up with like a summary thought on this critical thinking jazz, but that led us down this weird rabbit hole with the Star Wars and the Burger King. So
I think it relates, and it's a fun exercise. But obviously we could make, talking about salad and, lawn care.
Hey, there you go.
If we wanted to.
There you go. What if I were just to say to you all that guff about me getting all mad because of Star Wars and somebody goes, hey, look, it's just a movie. It's just a fun little fantasy thing. What are you getting so torqued up about? What you gotta yell at everybody about everything? Why don't you go stand on the street corner and just tell people how they're going to hell? You know?
You would be good at that, Jersey.
You think so? Oh, great.
No, I believe in you. I think you would find what street corner yellers do is a best practice, and then wonder how that applies to you. That guy really draws a crowd. What is he doing? His sleeves are rolled up. But is it more that he picks one guy to yell at, but this other guy diffuses it among a bunch of people? I don't know.
Actually, I will say that I don't know about you and your family life, but I am insufferable at home because I am constantly doing that with things that we're watching together. Like if Ann and I are just watching a thing, we just saw The Muppets.
Okay.
That new Muppet movie, which I was pleasantly surprised by. I did not want to see this movie because I love the Muppets, but I feel like their time has come and gone, and I don't want to get myself all emotionally frothed up about something like that. You know, it's like I don't want to watch them do Saturday Night Live jokes and make some innuendo that I think is inappropriate for their characters and everything. But the guy who wrote this movie really got what made them tick in the first place. He recaptured it, and I was really, really pleasantly surprised by it.
Wow.
Ann and I, we leave the movie theater, and when you leave a movie, you talk about it. You talk about, oh, I like this part, oh, I like that part. And then I went into this whole, you know what the stroke of brilliance was, is that the character Walter, who was, I don't think this is going to spoil anything, but it gives you an inroad to, like, I'm going to explain what the inroad to the story was, is that this character Walter, who is unsure about his identity and discovers that after all, he really was a Muppet, he becomes a vehicle character for us to get involved in the story. So when Kermit says, why don't you join us? He's asking all of us to join him. And it's a really great way to, by making him a Muppet, he's a cartoon, so we can invest ourselves in him. He's not just some kid who is going to feel other from us. It was a really great use of, like, the cartoon of puppetry to get the audience engaged and get the people who really love the Muppets to feel like they're involved in the story. And Anne's like, dude, punch out.
Punch out. Yeah.
And I was just excited. It wasn't a matter of me sitting back with my, my curly pipe and my ascot and saying like, oh, well, permit me to regale you with my vast knowledge on storytelling. It was a moment where I was just really excited about something really neat that I saw, and seeing the magician's sleight of hand and like, oh, I got to remember that one because I want to use that someday, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a danger when you're analyzing like that. And if it's exciting and addictive, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you feel like you were out of the moment by doing that? Did like somehow it diminished a magical thing?
No. This is something I warn my students all the time of. Is like, I was gratified by a 17-year-old girl in one of my classes who really has no aspirations of being a cartoonist, but she likes taking my classes. And she said, and what's weird is like, she is so atypical of most of my students. Most of my students that I get are kids who grew up on manga, Pokemon. They've always had an interest in cartoons and drawing, and they have that kind of like nerdy Harry Potter-ish edge to them. You know, you can tell that they have their culture, but they are by their parents look at them and go, whenever they see them, you know, they have that kind of look to them. Yeah. This kid looks like, you know, parents look at her and go, she's going someplace. She's prep school material, and she's a sweet kid, but she just doesn't have that nerd edge that all the other kids have. And so she can't speak their language. Like she doesn't really care for Harry Potter. She doesn't care for, you know, Miyazaki films or anything like that. She loves police procedural dramas, you know, like Criminal Minds, CSI Miami, stuff like that. And I warned my students very early on. I said, like, the more you get into this analysis stuff, the more you break this stuff down, the more you're going to be able to see the magician's tricks when you're watching stories. It's going to get harder to get lost in a story. And you lose something when that happens, but you gain something even more powerful in the sense that, A, you're constantly collecting story ideas. But B, is that when you do get lost, when a master storyteller tricks you into forgetting that you're watching a story, then it's like the Slurpee without the ice. It's just the concentrated juice, you know, and you get a really crazy rush out of that. But this 17-year-old girl who, you know, just like takes my classes for fun, she came to the class one day. She's like, oh my gosh, I totally made my dad angry because we were watching Criminal Minds. And, you know, I was predicting where they were going with all this stuff because I could start to see what the storyteller was doing and the way they were building this plot point. And it wasn't where she was deducing who the killer was, but she was understanding what these conflicts between these characters were trying to express, and she was unboxing it on the fly while her dad was just trying to watch the darn show, you know. And I was like, welcome to my world. but yeah, you know, it's like while I'm watching a thing like that, it's really rare these days that I'm not kind of like, I've got the director's commentary track on in one ear while the other ear is listening to the movie. It's really hard to just get lost in a story, and I don't want anybody to misunderstand that as me going like, well, I've achieved this level of transcendence, I've achieved my seventh chakra, and after all, I'm in a higher level of higher plane of existence than other people. No, it's just that.
I was wondering why the heck that book is levitating above your head, dude.
Well, my legs twisted up behind my head. Yeah. No, it's something you condition yourself to look for, and it becomes a reflex that you look for those things all the time. And you know what? I don't even know if I'm right. I don't even know if that's what the writer was thinking about when he was doing the one of the main characters of this movie as a Muppet who grew up as a regular boy. You know, I would assume that since it was a kind of a big plot point that he did mean it, but you know, unless I talk to the guy, I don't know. So I'm deducing these things. I'm internalizing them in the way that is makes sense to me, but you know, it's not about being right or wrong. It's about achieving whatever kind of understanding you can of the thing. Gosh, I don't know if any of those words amounted to anything.
No. So what I hear is that you know, in spite of your practice toward you know, analyzing story and understanding, having a deconstruction of it that makes sense to you based on your experience or whatnot, it's still in the end, you don't know for sure if that's the precise intention of the creator or whatnot. I mean, so you're left with questions at the end anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like you walked out with a doctoral thesis on the work. It's just that, you know, you pick up on a couple things, you suspect that this is what was intended, and whether it was or not, you've achieved a sort of a meta comprehension of a storytelling thing that will benefit you as a storyteller later on.
How does that then benefit? So if you have some kind of answer, but you don't know if it's the right answer, you're telling me that somehow is useful?
Yeah, because it's one more piece of the puzzle to play with, right? Okay. So like, okay, so we talk about vehicle characters, and kids' stories are replete with vehicle characters. Pete's Dragon, you know, the Disney film. You have the dragon. The dragon's the character we want to watch. The dragon's the character who's interesting. He's something we haven't seen before. He's animated. He's green. He makes funny noises. But then this dippy kid keeps walking around in front of the camera and get out of the shot, kid. I want to look at the dragon, you know. Transformers, you have Spike and Spark Plug later on. I'm trying to think if there was any, what other cartoons always had like a kid getting involved. Oh, Iron Giant, you've got Hogarth Hughes. I think Iron Giant did a better job of the vehicle character. The kid who we're supposed to identify with, invest ourselves in, he's representing our struggle within the context of this world. We identify with this kid because he represents all the potential that we could have. All the endless potential that we're constantly encountering, even if we think we're all washed up, right? So in thinking about that, by looking at another way to look at a vehicle character, by making the vehicle character into a Muppet and as a cartoon, even if that's not what the guy meant, that's what I got out of it. Now I can look at here's one more option in the blanket of vehicle character options that I've seen in stories as I've understood it. Now, how can I recombine this into an intentional expression in my story? And whether people get it or not is ultimately, my control over that is very limited. You know, I can use art, I can use craft and artistry and thinking to drive that point home as best I can. But ultimately, you know, it's really going to depend on the reader to pick up on that or not, right? Intuit it. They get it in their gut. I really like that guy. He was really funny and really cute. Well, did you like it because he was a Muppet? I don't know. He was just really funny and really cute, you know?
That's how a lot of my conversations go when they're analyzing stuff like that, depending on who I'm conversing with. But if someone who's also into the idea that, oh, maybe they want to also create, that's typically when you can have an interesting conversation on it. But getting back to your point, as far as, so it sounds like you're expanding your creative vocabulary somehow because of what you've observed before and you're testing it out again. So is that any different than like discovering a line art style that could really express something
that's exactly it.
Okay.
I mean, that's exactly the same thing. It's like when I discover an artist whose work I really, really, it connects with me somehow. It moves me. I can't stop staring at it. The next question is, why can't I stop staring at it? And then I'm going to start looking for the common traits. What particular panels jump out at me as being really, really cool? Oh, is it something in the pose? Is it something in the expression? Is it something in the composition? Is it something in the kind of lines? Matsutsuki Yamakami, an artist I've talked about hundreds of times, his lines just grabbed me by the throat like a rabid dog. And I was arrested by them for a couple of years. And I spent a long time, you know, staring at those books and not copying, not putting the book here and the paper here and just trying to mimic, but like really trying to deconstruct like, what it is about that line that I like, and how can I try to do that in my own way, right? So as to get in the same kind of ballpark as Yamakami without actually copying Yamakami, you know. So
I remember very distinctively the first time I was working at Burger King actually, and one of my coworkers handed me a metal band tape that I'd never heard before. And it was Megadeth, Rust in Peace. And by the time it hit that that peak solo near the final bridge in Holy Wars, I was literally floating through that place. I'll never forget hearing those notes the first time, and wondering at the same time, how could I possibly put that much passion and intensity into a moment of any expression? I want to do that. And so I then it was, you know, trying to figure out how do you do that? How do you move your fingers in that way? How do you have something to say to make your fingers move that? And all those kinds of things. Maybe the analysis is sort of trying to figure out how we can make others feel things have made us feel.
You know, we're both primarily self-taught. I think that's an important thing to underline here.
Mm.
I wonder how much of that has to do with it too. I wonder how much of that has to do with my rancor for a guru, you know, right? Because after all, I can do this. You know, I've experienced the empowering feeling of just looking up resources that can help me and putting them together in my head to make something come about, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, that is a certain style or affliction or addiction or something. Yeah, we probably have some shared bias there.
There's an irony there too, because then we're also, you know, putting together like a learning network with Lean Into Art. But the big difference is that we're just making resources for people to use as they see fit, rather than putting a prescriptive. One of the things you said in the message that you sent to me last night was, what do we mean by being, we don't want to be prescriptive? I mean, maybe we should define that. A little late now, mm-hmm. we're coming up on the end, yeah. but I mean, you know, what does that even mean?
So a prescription is something that you just follow. You blindly follow it. It's something written out for you that are orders you go execute to whatever end.
Take two of these.
Yep. Take two of these.
Yeah.
Yep. How many you take, when you take it, how you take it, et cetera. And I think a lot of, you can run into being self-taught, but what's so funny is being self-taught is also kind of a false dichotomy too. I have learned so much. I learned from so many people. It's not like the universe has this stuff that I just stare at really hard and all of a sudden it's in my head, you know? Yeah. There's people doing things that I observe and they're like, people.
You mean like using the force? Like just concentrate really hard and then magical things will start happening all around you? Yeah.
yeah. It's
I'm gonna ruin Star Wars for you. Yeah. You thought Lucas ruined it? Wait till I get my hands on it.
I know. You wow. Man, those are solid observations too. Obviously, the fantasy of force powers is pretty awesome, but you just turned it into something I hate.
it's a metaphor, and as long as you treat it like a metaphor and as a fantasy element, then it's totally awesome. But yeah.
Oh gosh. But yeah, people do things and sometimes there is that feeling of inspiration, but a lot of times it's curiosity. And there's this, it's like a snowballing effect where once I've initially experienced, because someone has expressed that this exists, that maybe, and sometimes I'll want to just do exactly what they did. Most of the time, it's not like that. I know that I won't be somehow drawing or playing a song in the same exact way. But I know that by going through it, I'm going to subject myself to something that will transmit an experience. And I'll be able to learn from that experience. I wrote something down last night that pertains as like something I was thinking about writing about user experience, but the only way to transmit experience is experience. So yeah, I don't know. And that's a theory. I don't know. I just wrote it down.
One of the things that I'm going to use the word Campbell again, I haven't mentioned Joseph Campbell in a while, but one of his lectures that he did that I think are really great is talks about young people who are trying too hard to be wise before they've experienced that in which it makes some, in relation to which it makes some sense to be wise, right? Like, so you have to actually go through stuff to become wise before you can actually be wise.
Sure.
No technology, no hyper-paced lifestyle is going to get you there. And you know, these things have to, Campbell says these things have to happen naturally. You have to go through you have to experience malice and hate and love and joy and depression and despair and all these different things before you can have any kind of sense of wisdom. To do anything else is to just recite from a book.
Yeah.
So,
which that would be the difference between incorporating something into your, you know, set of practices you intend to do again or whatever, like your tools or however you want to look at it, based on what you know because you tried it and you went through it versus something you were told. And yeah, so the whole self-taught thing, there's that aspect of it, but you just become a really good facilitator of your own experience tuned to help adapt to some new things that you want to do or try or whatever.
Mm.
It's not like, but it's not like you're somehow the isolated not integrated nutty professor or mad scientist or kooky artist that somehow tapped into the truth in a shortcut way, and they just do it by, you know, they talk to their dog and then they scribble crap on the wall and whatever. And oh, it's awesome and genius. It's because of connecting with others that really can help the process of being self-taught or whatever.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, you've seen the movie. God, we're talking a lot about movies this time, and it's all my fault.
That's cool.
Stranger Than Fiction?
No.
What's his name? Will Ferrell discovers that his life is being narrated by a narrator, and he finds out that he is a character in a book that is being written.
Oh.
And I will say no more, because it's actually a pretty interesting movie. I really don't care for what Will Ferrell as a comedian all that much, although I haven't been to Funny or Die, and I hear nothing but wonderful things about that website. But, you know, Elf, okay, that was kind of funny. But the other movies, like, just don't look like anything I'd be really interested in. But that movie was actually really interesting.
It sounds like a good premise.
Really interesting premise. Kind of some fun meta content for people who write. There's Dustin Hoffman's character is a literature professor at a university that Will Ferrell goes to for consultation to figure out what kind of story he's in. And Dustin Hoffman does, again, another actor that I'm like, I'm lukewarm about him. But in this, I thought he was really fun to watch because he was playing that kind of nutty professor character of absolutely unconcerned with what anybody else feels about him and the way he's behaving, like taking his socks and shoes off in his office and like eating yogurt sloppily because he's so consumed with his subject, you know? I look at guys like that. I'm like, I kind of want to be that guy. And Anne's like, don't be that guy. but anyway, it's a good movie that you should probably enjoy. Where was I going? Another thing that occurred to me that was probably implicit throughout everything we've been discussing, and I know we've touched on it a couple points, but I think you being the explicit guy, I'll defer to, or in deference to you, I will bring this up and make it more plain. A big idea of why critical thinking I think is really, really cool is the empowerment factor. When you are a critical thinker, you're on a level playing field with everybody else. You're a participant in the game, as it were, in the sense that you are investigating this along with everybody else. And there's nobody gets to hide behind the notion of, well, they're gifted. They've got a direct line to the Almighty, and he's pumping them full of all sorts of awareness and inspiration that you just don't have access to. I think about how ever since I got into this teaching jazz, I noticed a change occurred in me where I don't care who I'm talking to as long as we're talking about something interesting. And because of that, I can be around people who are famous, and I'm heavily using the air quotes here, you know, and that part isn't registering with me because I'm just like going, aren't comics really neat because of this and this and this and this? And like, don't you think that's neat? And conversely, somebody who's really famous can instantly become not very interesting to me because if I go, aren't comics neat because of this, this, and this? And they go, I don't know. And I go, oh, okay, we're done here. I'll go over to that guy who seems to be, thinking a little bit more about interesting stuff, you know? That kind of empower, like I talk with people who, because like, okay, let's put some think cards on the table here. I'm nobody in the landscape of comics. Wizard Magazine doesn't write articles about me. CBR doesn't write articles about me. If I go to a convent, like a comics party, like if I went to like the Eisner Awards or something, walked in and went, hey, everybody, people would be like, who's that jerk, right? I'm not saying this to be self-depreciating or anything. I'm just trying to get like, let's set some perspective here. I'm nobody, but I still don't look at, like when I'm doing shows like Comics Are Great or something, and I'm like, oh, I want to approach this person to be on my show. I don't ever say like, oh, that person's too famous to be on my show. You know, it's like, no, there's nobody who's too good to be on my show because I'm really proud of it and I think it's got good content. And I think as long as they're willing to come to the table with some interesting thoughts, I'd love to talk with them. That's my criteria. But I still hear people who are on a similar level, whatever you want to call it, as I am, in terms of our clout score, that evil thing. And they'll say like, oh, I can't talk to that person. They're comics royalty. What? No, you don't get to do that, you know, because that's putting them in some kind of like rarefied area. And I think that not thinking critically permits that kind of thinking a little bit more naturally. You know what I mean? Because you're assuming that they've got something magical that you don't got.
When the worst case scenario is like you get into a situation with them and you're in over your head and you end up learning a lot, right?
Yeah, really, really. Like, yeah, this is another one is like, how many times in like, let's just say in a month, do you go, no, I don't know what you're talking about. Explain, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a chance to accomplish what you probably were trying to accomplish anyway. It's just that, well, you're going to take a shorter route there because this person really has like some astounding observations or techniques or practice that just, I know we use martial arts as a metaphor or whatever, but it's good to not be afraid to connect with someone who's teaching, even though they may know a lot more than you and put you on your butt a lot or demonstrate how you're not blocking. But you're going to learn a lot by it. I mean, so you shouldn't be afraid to, engage and get out there. And even if you learn that well, the worst would be like they drop some kind of interesting knowledge and then are, disconnected and aloof and authoritative about it. So it's this mixed bag of like, well, boy, that's kind of useful, but I kind of don't like you. And this stinks.
Yeah.
How do you continue with it? But there's a, I don't know. It, I don't know. I think you put that it really super clearly. I was like trying in breaking it down, what this kind of self-taught thing, what this kind of critical thinking and, trying to be comfortable at integrating it with being creative and all that. It puts you on equal footing with the rest of the world and any other person on it. That can be scary and intimidating because, well, heck, for instance, like I guess if I met Dave Mustaine, right? I mean, I think I probably would be comfortable enough now to have some questions and whatnot. But like, I know for me, it actually even varies by discipline. With art, I'm really used to being this analytical now. With coding and visual design, I'm used to being this analytical. But with guitar, I'm a little bit more simple about that.
There's a difference too. You're talking about an example where somebody had a profound impact on you developmentally, emotionally. They came around at a really critical time and had a deep, deep impact on you. That's right. A different thing. That's a different thing than being at, say, a convention and here's so-and-so who's got X amount more thousand followers than you on Twitter. You know, and it's like, okay, this person is maybe a year older than you, maybe 5 years younger than you. And like, are you going to say to me that, oh, I can't talk to them. They're famous. They're so much more talented than me. I just make a fool of myself if I talk to them. Wow. That's too bad. That's too bad that you feel that way. But when you're going up to somebody who had like a really deep and profound impact on your life in some way, I think you're permitted to be a little tongue-tied, because how do you find the words to communicate that meaning to somebody? You know, it's really, you can't. So
yeah, well, now I don't think that's important. Now I would say there's some other, use for this interaction that, those feelings are separate than this meeting, right? Yeah. That's how I would look at it, honestly. Because if I just sat there and imagined that feeling at Burger King or whatever, being, experiencing something pretty, pretty amazing. And, what the heck do you say about that? Right. I mean, that's, good job. What happened after that album? I don't know.
I met Dan Mishkin in 2006 at Heroes Con in North Carolina. And, now I organize a convention with the man. So what we're talking about, 5 years I've known him. It's only in the last year or so that I've accurately communicated to him how much his work had, what kind of long-term impact his work had on me as a child, as a 10-year-old reading his stuff, how that steered the direction of where I wanted to go with my storytelling, with my craft, and who I am as a person. It had very, very deep and profound impact, but it took years of sharing anecdotes at the right time and not waiting for them You know, not like, oh, I can't wait to tell him this story. But it's like, he'll say something. I'll be like, oh, you know, that reminds me of when you did this in Blue Devil. And he's like, you remember that? I'm like, dude, you know, here's three characters in the front who are named after characters or designed after characters that you created, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, that's a long term kind of thing that can come out. That you don't say that in the first 5 minutes because it's something they've heard a million times. B, it's something that can't be encapsulated in a sentence. Dude, you really changed my life. Oh, thanks a lot. Those words are meaningless.
Exactly. It's because what's the point of that? I mean, so the a lot of it's there's a communication. There's a you don't have to have be this calculated or whatever, but like. If you are caring to go through that act of connecting with someone, I mean, it's the same with any sort of creative piece that's meant to communicate. Like, what are you trying to get across, and why, and how do you intend to do that? Or it's at least a good place to start, and then just go with the flow after that.
Yep.
But I mean, so I think it very much it's kind of fun. We took some interesting. Wild, I did not expect, this is what I wanted out of this conversation. Is
good.
I wanted us to like take interesting swings at this question. We don't have an answer to it. It's we know like why we're doing this thing at Lean Into Art. I love that you pointed out the, do you care if I go one more level explicit on something you mentioned?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Who are we to do Lean Into Art? Right? I mean, in some regards, it's like, it's meant to be an educational entity thing, right? What is it? Is it a community? It's a learning network. So whoever said that, that's cool. I like that.
Ann, that was Ann. Give Ann, credit Ann where it's due. Okay.
Great observation, and I appreciate her telling us that because, yeah, okay, cool. It is kind of a learning network. What the heck's a learning network? I don't know. We're building it, and I think it makes sense to call this that.
Yeah.
Who are we to do it? You know? You can go up and search the internet and look at both of us and things that we've done over the years and you know, come up with your own answer. But then who are, I mean, I can explain why more or less, if you go to the about page, you get a good feel for what captures the spirit of what set us on this path. But I could easily, talk up or talk down aspects of myself and my past that relate to this mission. That, what it comes down to is I feel ready to commit and do good things in service of this goal. And I feel empowered to do it because I've practiced doing this kind of self-taught kind of approach for some time, which is if you immerse yourself in it, it's very empowering. So it's not like I feel like someone told me I could do it or there's no higher power or whatever. It's it seems
like the Blues Brothers, we're on a mission from God.
I suppose I have strong feelings on the matter, so I could somehow ascribe that to a Chicagoan accent mission from God. but I don't know. I don't want to just sit here and like talk myself down either or whatever. I don't think you really did that, Jersey, but I think I would probably go too quick down the path of like, look at how unqualified I am for this. That, if you're here and you think, over the months you'll see classes that I offer and, I'm definitely behind the scenes helping, make this thing work. And you feel it's useful, cool. If you don't, I hope you do find sources that do serve you well.
Yeah.
And
the point is we get to do this. And as long as we give it our level best, right? And that's not to say that it doesn't matter if you won the game or not, son, as long as you had a good time and did your level best. No, you want to win too. Let's face it, we're humans. We want to do a really good job with what we do. And it's funny. I mean, we talked earlier about this whole idea of like all the students in my class have to justify their thoughts and positions. And like, it's like, well, then who are you to do it? Okay, well, I guess we got to justify that. But what's funny, and this is the big,
why not?
This is the big irony. The big irony is that one of my pet peeves in life, as in my personal life, is justifying why I do what I do. There was an episode of The Simpsons the other day, or last week, or week before, where Marge becomes a foodie, and Homer says to her, "Is like, I don't want to think about food. I want to like it." And in a lot of aspects of my life, I am not very analytical. And it's like, if I like this jacket and I want to purchase it, and if I have the money to purchase it, I'm going to purchase it. And I don't want to go into a dissertation on why this is an appropriate jacket for me, or why it fits into this style or that style, and who, what does it say about me? If I looked at it and went, neat, then I get the jacket. You know, like, so in certain parts of my life, it's like critical thinking is off the table, because then it's just, I feel like I'm making excuses for everything that I do.
Right.
So, because I don't want to turn it, I don't want anybody to think that's my life. It's like, well, let's see, is it going to be eggs or is it going to be sausage? Eggs or sausage? Eggs or sausage? I don't know. You know, let's break it down into a chart. Let's whiteboard this for a little bit. No,
no, that's, emotions are really helpful to get you through that stuff. Just like, no, I like eggs more. No, I like sausage. Then just you're done. You move on. You like the jacket? Cool. You move on.
Right. I mean,
and in some ways, you're saving it for the things that. More gray area.
Maybe that's it. Maybe I save up that stuff for the stuff that I'm really passionate about, and I don't want to dilly-dally on other parts of my life where it's like, you know, I'm actually one of those good husbands who will go clothes shopping with my wife and like actually talk with her about it. And I'll look for things like, this looks like it's you, you know. Does that surprise anybody? Does that surprise anybody at all that I'm that kind of husband? No, it doesn't. So we'll move on. But when it comes to shopping for myself, it's just like pants. Okay, here's pants. I got pants. I don't need any pants anymore. You know, that kind of an idea. And I don't want to spend too much time on it. But anyway, so it's kind of funny that like that's like a hot button issue with me. Is like, if you spend a lot of time explaining why you purchased the thing, I'll be like, all right, I got it and got it. Don't justify it anymore. You liked it. You got it. Shut up. You know. But in other areas, I demand explicit. You know. Explanation.
Yeah. So that seems to make sense too. So it's not, it doesn't fit everything, but
it also goes to show that we're complicated creatures, and we are permitted to be a little hypocritical sometimes. It's okay.
No doubt. Yeah. Yeah. And I acknowledge, you know, being a self-taught person doing something that's a learning network, there could be some hypocrisy there. Like, you, well, what authoritative institution told you that you could go do this, Rob Stenzinger? Nobody. Yeah. but I feel ready to do it, and I do feel like we're ready to succeed. I've had lots of practice doing various businesses and services and whatever creative things over the years. But yeah, so that's a pretty brief synopsis why I feel justified in doing it, but
so anyway, that was all to say that we're not going to shirk away from if anybody demands an explanation. You know, we're not going to say, well, because, dude.
No,
but anyway, you know, I don't know. I think we came around the horn on this one. We walked around the whole field and kind of like took a stab at each base. I ruined Star Wars for you.
You did. My child, actually the Clone Wars cartoon was resurrecting my childhood dream, and with your mighty brain, you you disintegrated it.
Only if you buy into my hyper West thinking of, you know, individuals are supreme, individuals are the best, and submitting to you know. And here's another note of hypocrisy. You know what one of my favorite kinds of music is? Choral, where you have a group of people all singing together, and I can't pin down what it is about it that moves me so much, except that it's all these people all united for a single purpose, and that's kind of neat to see. Boy, that's not individualism. Nobody gets to shine in that environment. It's all a group effort, you know? So.
We're funny. Everyone, yeah, that's, yeah, there's a lot of, hypocrisy, mixed message.
But you want to know why? Because it's all true. You know, it's like, it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And unfortunately, that's not a very pleasant thing to hear. Nobody wants to hear that it's, you know, that there's not good and evil, and we can just point at those evil people and go get them, you know? But
yeah, so let's see, critical thinking.
We don't have to summarize it.
Yeah, no, I don't think there is a summary. It's it was fun to tackle, even though there is no final answer on it. And it's like, it was fun to get meta with it, with guess what? We can throw it at ourselves, and you know, it's like, ah, there's a snake in my lap, and then we we try to cope with that for a while.
So everybody come to the Lean Into Art Retreat. Where you'll experience such events as there's a snake in my lap.
Exactly.
That'll be the next step, is designing some kind of physical kind of conference-y thing. Taking people out of their comfort zones.
Sure. Whoopee cushions on every other chair.
Oh, God.
little flies within ice cubes. Fake ones.
And those bow ties that spin around when you pull a string.
Yep.
Oh man,
we'll extract deep messages out of anything we can find in the silly prank catalog. Why? Because people need us to tell them what to think.
Buy my second book. Get my pocket organizer. It's got uplifting expressions written on it, designed by me. So every time you go for that change purse, it'll say, "What have you thought about today?" What's the art mullet? Yeah. What's your art mullet? What's inside of your art mullet?
It's touching. And then that that makes me feel like I thought about something. So now I don't have to think anymore.
And then you can get the the rear view mirror hang down tag, which has some uplifting expressions on it. So every time, you know, you start to drive, you'll be thinking about me and the thoughts that you can only get from me. Keep you going.
Yep. You want that Jersey's brand to feel good.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
If there is a hell, that's what mine will be, is that being put in that position.
The authoritarian.
Oh. All right. So, hey, we're going to keep doing this thing, I guess, where every other episode of Lean Into Art will be an audio only, and then the other one will be a video audio. And the video
the current plan.
The video ones will have a bit of a visual aspect to it, like the last episode we did where we had the photoshopping and illustrating going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the audio ones will be more of our, you know, deep thought, try to wrestle with a snake in our lap.
Yeah. Who knows what we'll come up with the next one.
Yeah.
Creative. Yeah. This was a big one.
Well, what's funny is when you threw the idea at me last night, I admitted that, like, you know, I don't even know what I think about this subject, but I'll try. I'll give it a try. And I think I wound up talking more, like, three times more than you did this episode.
You're analyzing the waveform?
I'm looking at the waveform now, yeah. And yeah, it's like, you know what I think I was doing? I think it was entirely vamping. I think I was just trying to fill the space with noise so it sounds like I'm thinking about it as I'm desperately trying to come up with the idea based on what the topic was.
Yeah, well, that's, there you go. Mission accomplished.
All right, so leanintoart.com. Well, there's going to be some news to be posted about what we're going to do with the 30 classes and 30 days stuff. Mm. So people can follow us on the Twitters at leanintoart. That's the handle, right? The username. You made a Google Plus page.
And I did, yeah. So you can follow us on Google Plus. I'm working on making that a regular stop. But still working on that habit, you know, like Google Plus, as I mentioned, is kind of like this extra thing where I'm getting into it and I like it. But now we have another extra thing, the page on Google Plus.
I know.
So anyway, we'll work on making that fun.
Yeah. As soon as we figure out what to do with Google Plus pages, I mean, the functionality still is pretty, you know, stripped down and rudimentary.
Very true.
So, but we'll figure it out. But yes, that's where you can, you know, or just leanintoart.com if you want some updates on, you know, what you could subscribe to our RSS feed, and then you just look at your feed reader and it'll say, hey, there's a thing from Lean Into Art. They did something really neat that you might want to look at. Because we got to figure out what we're going to do with all this content, how we're going to make it available to people, once it's all done. So,
yeah, exactly. I was just trying to look up too on the site. You have, after 30 classes in 30 days is up, you do have some workshops coming up in December as well.
Oh, I do.
And, so please check out the site to sign up for those. I think you're doing another one of the, coloring with Photoshop, right?
Yeah. Coloring with Adobe Photoshop Elements, another live edition of that, I think December 6th or something like that. Is that right? Or December 5th, one of the two. And then I think I'm writing with images was one of the other ones, like a sort of like a general, like a if you ever wanted to sample what one of my long-term workshops, like Comics Fundamentals is like, it's like sort of like an intro piece with an assignment at the end.
So yeah, Write with Images is Saturday, December 3rd at 6 p.m. Eastern time. And the Photoshop Elements is a two-day workshop. One-day workshop also.
You scared me.
Keeping you on your toes. It's Monday, December 5th at 6 p.m. Eastern. So, excellent.
You can sign up and then you can participate in the live class. And then afterwards, you will have access to the video indefinitely. You also are granted indefinite forum access where assignments are posted and the extra attention is paid to the members by me and Rob. So you sign up for one class, you get lifetime access to the forum, and you get a lifetime access to the whatever class you participated in. So, not bad.
Not bad. We are not restrictive and DRM-ish about our content. We want you to, you know, join us in the class and then use it on your TV or your iPod or whatever you need to do to enjoy it. So. Heard some fun anecdotes as far as how people have used their 30 classes content as far as, you know, commuting and as far as like on break at work.
Oh, and in the forums, there's some community building going on right now. The student, the members, I don't want to say students, I want to say members, they're all beginning to interact with each other and share each other's work and give each other advice and support. And that's encouraging to see too. That's kind of cool. So it is turning into a learning network. I'm excited about that.
Yep, super cool.
All right, well, thanks for the fun talk, Rob.
Yeah, thank you, Jersey. Okay. That was, good times.
Good time, great place.
Yep.
All right, so until next time, may the force be with you or not. I've been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
Yep, this is Mark calling Orson. Wait, I am Rob Stenzinger, and you can check me out on the web at interactive-storyteller.com. Or Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.